From Michigan Radio, this is Stateside. I'm April Baer. A Detroit speech by Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. acts as a workshop for one of the most important moments in U.S. history.
But really, Detroit was the real forerunner for that March on Washington in August of 1963.
Today on the show, we step back in time to the summer of 63 to hear how Dr. King set the stage in Detroit for the March on Washington. Also, Michigan voters talk about their issues and concerns for Election Day 2020, and we go over this year's list of Michigan notable books, everything from new fiction to gripping history.
There's things that just hit me because they are so identifiable to me as Michigan and also have a great story.
Two librarians are going to give us their picks. Hope your bookshelf can take a little bit more weight. That's coming right up. Welcome to Stateside. I'm April Baer. Today on the show, Dr. Martin Luther King Jr.'s 1963 visit to Detroit, where he previewed language and themes that would become world famous at the March on Washington later that year. But first, it's a late Monday night in early November. Crowds are gathered at DeVos Place Convention Center in Grand Rapids, and they're there to see candidate Donald Trump. When he finally takes the stage, it's past midnight, officially Election Day 2016.
Today is our Independence Day. Today, the American working class is going to strike back, finally.
That day, Trump did something even his staff hadn't expected. He won Michigan's 16 electoral votes. The state hadn't gone to a Republican since 1988. Trump won by fewer than 11,000 votes. That's the narrowest margin he had in any state. The blue-collar, union-heavy workforce that was once a reliable base of Democratic support had fallen to the Republican Party, along with Wisconsin and Pennsylvania. In all, fewer than 80,000 votes across these three states swung the election to Trump. As we look forward to this November, a lot of people are wondering if this was an anomaly. Was it just a protest vote against Hillary Clinton? Or is the Democratic Party's base undergoing a more permanent realignment? Today, we're going to explore this by speaking to voters from three areas of the Detroit region, each representing an important political constituency for winning Michigan this year. It's part of Michigan Radio's partnership with 1A's Across America project. James Morrison, 1A's Across America producer, takes it from here.
Kathleen Van Poplin and I are walking just off Main Street in Rochester, Michigan. It's an affluent suburb about an hour's drive north of Detroit. Black squirrels with brown tails dart between new homes that line each side of the street.
There's all sorts of crazy little squirrels around here.
Van Poplin and her husband have lived in this city of roughly 12,000 people for more than four decades. She was a registered nurse. He was a police officer. They're both retired now. But most of their time in this area, their neighbors have been managers and executives with the big automakers in Detroit.
Our subdivision, you could bowl down the middle of the street when it was GM breaks or holidays or whatever, because everybody was gone. Lots and lots of money. Our local hospital made so much money because everybody had the Cadillac, literally and figuratively, insurance from Generous Motors, they used to call it back in the day, Generous Motors.
Those white-collar auto workers made this one of the richest places in the nation during the 80s and into the 1990s. While the population of nearby Detroit is 80% black, the population here is 90% white. It's been a Republican stronghold for decades, but that's changing. Van Poplin says she's voted for every Republican presidential candidate since 1972, except for Donald Trump.
He's like a tyrant. You could tell that he really didn't have full grasp of a lot of the issues.
She voted for a third-party candidate, but decided to give Trump a chance once he won.
Well, that disillusionment hit pretty fast that he is just completely ill-equipped to be our president. If you hit me, I'm going to hit you two times as hard. It's like, what is this, second grade? I mean, it's just ridiculous, the childish mentality he has, even towards world politics.
In 2018... her dislike of Trump led her to do something she never did before. She considered voting for the area's Democratic candidate for Congress, Alyssa Slotkin. She says she liked Slotkin's integrity, her CIA background, and her promise to make prescription drugs more affordable. Not only did Van Poplin end up voting for Slotkin, She actively campaigned for her.
I actually wound up knocking on doors, making phone calls. There is no way in the world I would have ever done that a year, you know, prior to that, ever. I don't care who it was. But I felt it was that important that she get elected.
Women voters like Van Poplin helped Slotkin win Michigan's 8th congressional district and flip a House seat blue that had been in Republican control for nearly two decades. Van Poplin represents a new constituency for Democratic candidates, suburban Republican women who have defected from the party under President Trump. She's white, fiscally conservative, socially liberal, and wants restrictions on access to abortion. She says she'll vote for a Democratic presidential candidate in 2020, but only if it's a moderate.
And I just feel the Democrats are shooting themselves in the foot, because if you don't want Trump reelected, you got to show a strong front and give us somebody that we can vote for. But if you give me some wild-eyed, so far to the left we can't even see that end of the bell curve person, you're leaving me with no choice.
The Democratic Party may be gaining support from fiscally conservative women like Van Poplin, but it's losing support from white, blue-collar workers like Brian DeHinno. I'm climbing into his new Ford F-250 pickup truck in Clinton Township, Michigan, a suburb about 30 minutes north of Detroit.
I had to have a bent seat. If I can't have that, then I don't want to buy the truck.
We spoke with DeHinno on 1A last May. Since then, his business has continued to grow, which is why he's needed the new truck.
My life has totally done a 180 in the last 3 years. And, you know, I can't attribute it to any other thing other than the fact that Donald Trump's in office.
DeHinno and voters like him helped Barack Obama and Joe Biden win Macomb County with nearly 54% of the vote in 2008. Those same voters then backed Trump in 2016 to give him a victory of the same margin. Many credit this swap of party allegiances as the reason Trump won Michigan. DeHinno drives me through a manufacturing corridor on the edge of Detroit to show me why President Trump is popular here.
I mean, as you can see, there's help wanted signs, very little space for lease. I mean, do the roads still suck? They sure do. But, I mean, look, man, we're getting there, you know? See, look, you got a Furley's building right here, and you got people walking on the roof. There's only one reason they're putting a roof on it. It's because they're going to lease it out. All these places used to be empty. You should have seen this, James. You should have seen this 5, 6, 7 years ago. This place was a ghost town.
Trump-Pence 2020 signs are proudly displayed in business windows up and down Grosbeck Avenue. DeHinno credits Trump's trade policy and deregulation agenda for fueling the economic recovery people here have been eagerly awaiting for decades. As we cross 8 Mile Road into the city of Detroit, DeHinno pulls down a street lined with homes in disrepair. Roofs are caved in, windows shattered. A minivan sits directly on the pavement, no tires, no doors, no windows. DeHinno says this is why Democrats will have a hard time winning back blue-collar voters in the suburbs of Detroit.
You know, this is Detroit, man. It's a Democrat stronghold of Democrat strongholds. This is what your Democrat policies did. This is where my family's been here for 300 years. I didn't come to America. America came to us. And this is what Democrat policies did to my city.
He doesn't understand policy.
This is Jacinda Kaysen.
I am an activist, advocate, agitator, and a small business owner.
Kaysen works all over the majority black city of Detroit. We're walking towards 8 Mile Wall on the north side of the city. It's a 6-foot-tall concrete barrier built to separate white families from black families at the height of redlining, a policy that used race to determine where banks and the U.S. government loaned money.
They can get a home loan to fix their roofs because they lived in a good neighborhood. This community got no home loans because they was in a community that was deemed, had a red letter grade. They got to have the upkeep of theirs. They didn't.
As we drive towards downtown, Kaysen takes me past an area where black families were historically segregated next to heavy industry.
You smell that? Do you smell it?
Yeah, it smells like burning rubber.
And this is what these people have to live with.
Kaysen says policies that have denied black Detroiters loans, segregated them near industrial production, and busted their labor unions are responsible for many of the problems people here face. She says that's not solely a failure of the Democratic or Republican Party. It's a failure of capitalism. She says that's why messages of progressives like Bernie Sanders and Elizabeth Warren resonate with voters here. But Kasin says she's still not ready to rally behind any of the candidates.
None of these people are speaking to the things that apply to me. You know, none of them are really speaking to issues that affect Black people. And for them to totally disregard us because they know that we're going to vote Democratic anyway is kind of insulting. It's extremely insulting. This is one of the most lethargic races that I've been in because I feel sad, you know? I feel sad that this man just might win again because nobody is looking to talk to the Black people to energize the base. And it's frustrating.
Kasin says Democrats have taken Black votes for granted. She says that's partly why Hillary Clinton got nearly 100,000 fewer votes than Barack Obama did in Detroit 8 years earlier. She drives me to Midtown Detroit to explain why.
This is new. This restaurant's new. This is 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 new. This place right here got some good chicken wings. I know that sounds Black, but I'm serious. It's like...
Kasin says many of Detroit's Black families are being left out of the city's newfound economic prosperity. She says Democrats need to offer Black Detroiters policies that allow them to access the same economic success as their white neighbors. She says if Democrats are expecting Black Detroiters to simply turn up to vote against President Trump, they're making a huge mistake.
A vote against Trump is not a vote, you know, for Black people. It worked for white people because they voted for Trump against Hillary. But that's not going to win over Black people. It might energize other bases, but that's not an energizing base for Black people. We need our issues addressed. Period.
That was Kathleen Van Poplin, Brian DeHeno, and Jacinda Kasin speaking with producer James Morrison. You want to tell us about the issues informing your choice this year? We want to hear about them. Send an email to stateside@michiganradio.org or leave us a comment on Twitter at Stateside Radio. We're looking forward to hearing from you. After the break, your winter reading list gets delightfully longer. We're going to go over this year's list of Michigan notable books, fiction, nonfiction, even a cookbook.
I knew seeing this book, and I'm not a cookbook person. When I looked at this book, the first thing before I even looked at the recipes was, this book is beautiful.
Stick around. You're listening to Stateside. I'm April Baer. Have you plowed through all those books that people gave you over the holidays? Me too. Time to tee off on your next wave of winter reads. Every year, the Library of Michigan compiles a list of Michigan notable books. We're talking stories about Michigan or set here, and also those written by Michigan authors. Today, we're welcoming two of the librarians involved in the selection process. Tim Gleisner is manager of special collections at the Library of Michigan. Tim, how are you doing?
I'm good today. Thank you, April.
And Jessica Trotter is a librarian with the Capital Area District Library. Jessica, thanks for being here.
Thanks for having us.
All these books have to have some connection to Michigan, whether they are about Michigan or written by someone who's from here. But that word that you use to title the list, notable, it is wonderfully flexible. What, in your view, makes a book really notable? What boxes does it have to tick as you're reading it?
I'll start. I guess for me, one thing that really stands out for many of the books that we choose is just something that it's hard to really put your arms around it, but basically just, you know, when you read it, you know it. Like, you absolutely know it. Or if you see the book, one of the books I'm going to talk about today, as soon as I saw it, I mean, I knew it was a notable book. And usually the committee overall has that same feeling.
Jessica, how would you answer that question?
I understand what Tim is talking about, but also for me, there's a bit of relevance that pops out for me. I'm thinking of a couple of the titles, actually, including the titles that Tim's going to talk about. There's just something about them that speaks to the year that we're looking at or the year that we're looking forward to. There's things that just hit me because they are so identifiable to me as Michigan. And just also have a great story or a great, you know, premise, whatever type of book it is.
And actually, I would jump on what Jessica is saying. I mean, I completely agree with her because there were two titles from last year's list that would not, I think, really be as relevant for this year. And we would have passed on just due to the topic and the currency of the topic.
Right. I don't know that we'd have passed on them this year.
There's one from this year, and I guess I can give the title, The Girls, about the Larry Nassar case that just was something that just, I mean, you knew, but when you read it, you absolutely were like, yes, we have to have this book. But the currency of it was just something that, I mean, you had to look at it at the very least to just know that it was a title for this year.
Do you think there are things that set the Great Lakes literary tradition apart?
I mean, I think the question of water, just the lakes themselves, a book that won Death and Life of the Great Lakes. I mean, I think that's something that really stands out for me. And then really books that I've seen, industrial settings, for some reason that pops out in my mind. But Jessica, I'm sure, can speak.
Oh, I'm kind of thinking about some of the ones that we're looking at this year and thinking more about. There's a Michigan twist on Midwest that I think...
Oh, as a Buckeye, I really am curious to hear what you mean by that. Could you say more?
Well, in a way, it's kind of going into one of the books that I want to talk about. So there are books where it's very clear that the person is sort of coming from somewhere else and trying to get used to the Midwest. And, you know, part of it's just pulling in the iconic things that have shaped Michigan, such as everything going on in Detroit, the industrial part of it, the cultural Motown, things like that. I mean, it just pulls a little different to me than maybe some of the other Midwestern states.
Well, let's get to it. Jessica, what's the book that you have in mind about this?
This one's actually Come See About Me, Marvin. It's poems by Brian G. Gilmore. This one really hit me. Gilmore's, he's from D.C. originally, and he came to Michigan to teach social justice law at MSU. And this collection is sort of that getting to know you part of, you know, adjusting to Michigan. And it's presented as sort of a dialogue with Marvin Gaye.
Oh, wow.
Who also left D.C. to further his career and ended up in the Midwest, first in Chicago and then in Detroit.
I think a lot of people may get a little intimidated by poetry. They worry that they won't get it. What's your pitch to people for picking up this book?
This one's so accessible. It's so, part of it's very clearly mid-Michigan. Not totally, but there are things that are just very clearly mid-Michigan. He's talking about places I can identify on the road on I-96, like his first winter bad weather driving. Was going to a presentation in Grand Rapids and hitting, there is a spot on I-96, which I have hit, I don't know how many times, that ice is over before you get to an emergency exit. And it's like I can see it in this particular set of poems. He does just a very good job of bringing very real places to life.
Is there something from the book you could read to us?
Yeah. There are a number that are just, I think my favorites are probably very long. But actually, this one is the Grand Rapids poem. It's called Grand Rapids for KK. I'm just going to read a first stanza of it.
Sure.
And then the snow came, like in that book, into thin air. And I was happy we weren't climbing the Himalayas. I was just on my way to Grand Rapids to do a seminar on discrimination. And we were just about there when someone tossed a white bed sheet on our windshield and our tires became skates on a sheet of ice. Now I knew why much of the time on these trips you could look to the right or left and you could see cars in the trees, driver out, airbags engaged, cell phone in the air.
That's amazing.
And that goes on. That's actually a longer poem. And it's just one of those things where you're like, I know exactly the spot he's talking about. I have driven past those cars and I know that situation.
Tim, one of the books that you chose is a cookbook this year. Mm-hmm. It's called Roughage, A Practical Guide to Vegetables. Will you tell us a little bit more about the author, Abra Behrens?
Well, Abra is a chef and farmer here in Michigan, currently in Three Oaks, previously in Northport up in the Leelanau Peninsula, and then also over, she was trained over at Zingerman's Deli. And the reason why I said earlier that there are books that you just know that are notable titles, I knew seeing this book, and I'm not a cookbook person. When I looked at this book, the first thing before I even looked at the recipes was, this book is beautiful. Just in the format that it's in, the cover itself, the illustrations, just the way it's broken up by, you know, the sections or chapters by vegetable, you know, one vegetable, discrete vegetable per chapter. So Abra Barons is this person who very much believes in seasonal, you know, eating, and it's just a wonderful book broken up with different vignettes of her life with experiences of cooking. One very powerful one is in the section about broccoli, where her father is like literally cooking to heal himself. And she shares that experience with him cooking bacon after the passing of her mother, his wife. I can't speak enough about this book. For me, this was like the one where, one of them where I just basically am like, yep, that's a notable book.
Have you made any of the dishes from the book yet?
Yeah, I've made two dishes. One was broccoli, fitting enough, because I love broccoli. And it was really just essentially, you know, basically dousing it oil, chili flakes, roasting the broccoli with the chili oil, or the oil and the chili flakes, and then basically grating Parmesan cheese on it. That was my dinner that one night when I made that. And then another one was carrots, again, roasting, but this time with a jam and almonds. And it was just a fantastic meal. And the one thing I love about her recipes is she speaks to someone like me, where she says, you know, if you're going to, you know, douse these in oil, use a glug of oil, you know, and like I can picture in my mind what a glug is, right? Like you just kind of shoot the oil in the bowl and then you, right? And so, I mean, it's very simple, easy for someone like me who, quite frankly, when it comes to vegetables, if it's not out of a frozen bag when I get home at night, I really don't do much else. Yeah, I just can't speak enough about this book.
That sounds amazing. Jessica, another one of your favorites from the list is The Care and Feeding of Ravenously Hungry Girls by Anissa Gray. She gets my vote for best title, by the way.
Yes.
Now,
yes.
Anissa Gray grew up in Western Michigan, and that's where the book's set. It covers
St. Joseph.
Right. It covers the lives of three sisters. What's going on when we meet these women?
This is just in the aftermath of Althea and her husband, so the oldest sister and her husband, have just been arrested and convicted for defrauding their West Michigan community. And the two younger sisters are coming into town to look after their nieces. They have two nieces. And it's just, it's a family in crisis. And it's, everything is bringing out all the faults that have shaped this family. Mm. And it's just starting to crumble, and you know, people will come through stronger, but it's looks at relationships between mothers and daughters. Althea basically raised her sisters, especially her baby sister. So it's mothers and daughters, it's relationships between siblings. There's a lot about issues of identity and body image, guilt and regrets. And it's one of those things, it was compared to The Mothers by Britt Bennett and T.R.I. Jones's An American Marriage.
Another couple of books about family.
Exactly. And and for me, it was a surprisingly fast read for something that's so emotionally weighty. There's discussion of eating disorders. There's a lot going on in it.
Could you contrast it a bit with the two books by T.R.I. Jones and Britt Bennett that we just mentioned? What corners of family and identity does it explore that maybe we haven't seen anywhere else?
Well, the youngest sister has an eating disorder that she has been she's basically backslid on as these events are happening. She is split from a partner. She's in the Chicago area and coming up into West Michigan to help with the children it's a teenager who basically turned her mother and father in. She's sort of the whistleblower on this crime.
Wow.
And yeah, I mean, so you've got all sorts of things going on. It's just the sisters part of it, and how that family dynamic of how if you lose a parent early, those relationships get really screwed up, in that, you know, an oldest child may be raising the youngest child, that middle child gets somewhere lost in between. It's just a really interesting look at those relationships.
It sounds like one that'll stick with us for a long time.
It was actually the first thing I read last year, and I really, it never let go. in that sense. I was really fought for this one. I really, really wanted to make sure nothing happened and it made the list.
There was a strong contingent on the committee for that book.
Yes, they loved it. Yes.
They wanted that book beyond all else. Yeah.
Tim, I wanted to ask about another one of your picks. It's a nonfiction title called A Good American Family, The Red Scare and My Father by David Moranis. He's an associate editor at The Washington Post. What's the Michigan connection here?
Well, it's a trial that takes place back in the early 1950s in Detroit. Basically, it's during the Red Scare of the early 50s, the McCarthy era. And really, the Michigan connection is Elliot Marinus, the father of David, basically is put on trial for being a supposed communist at that time because of past connections that he had had earlier in life while he was attending school at U of M. For me, this is one of those books that really, when Jessica talks about, you know, this is a Michigan book, and really, the setting of it, I'm not a native Michigander, but I don't think you could put this in my native state of Wisconsin, even my native hometown in Milwaukee. This is a Detroit story. The one that stands out to me the most is the grandmother who was the FBI informant in the local communist headquarters. And she, for years, was taking notes and passing along information on all these different people that she was coming into contact with, you know, in Detroit in the 30s and 40s, and basically keeping files on all of them, and nobody knew. Nobody had a clue. Nobody had an inkling of this woman who really was embedded, in the labor movement, the left movement of that time in Detroit. And it just, the sheer volume of sources and notes and research that David Marinus did on this book, and the cast of characters, how they all came to Detroit, it really paints a scene of Detroit of being so diverse, grabbing so many people from so many different parts of the country who really made up that city, you know, from the large African-American population to the people who were coming from, you know, the rural Appalachian area, all mingling into this one urban setting, and then just really seeing like the scare, the Red Scare, not in Washington, D.C., like how we see it on TV today, you know, with McCarthy and everything else, but here in the center of the country, in Detroit, which was the labor capital of the United States, is probably still is today, you know, but I mean, it was just amazing.
Yeah, it seems like a little different picture of Detroit in the 50s than a lot of us have, you know, that level of betrayal and division.
Well, and, you know, and I think it was really endemic of the country as a whole, but to me, it was just, I think the thing to me is how complex that city is. You know, having lived in Michigan now for 20 years, I still sometimes can't get my head around Detroit. Detroit is a very complex, has a very extremely complex history. And this book, you know, touches on an aspect of it. In a time and a place that obviously was fraught with many divisions in our society. And I think that's another thing that really touched me was just looking at our current state of affairs today, you know, and realizing this has happened before. And you know, this is something that, you know, maybe will happen again, hopefully not. But if it does, it's not the end of the world. There is hope. Again, this is one where after reading maybe 100, 150 pages, I'm like, this is a notable book. Mm-hmm.
You know, you touched on this with something you said before, but I have to ask, are the conversations when the committee gets together and really starts getting down to brass tacks about which books are going to make the list, are those friendly conversations, or what's the room like?
They can be. No, they can be. I think sometimes people get very passionate about certain books. Mm-hmm. Another one that we knew that was extremely notable was Broke. And I know, you know, that's a different title altogether. But Broke was one that people got very passionate about in the last meeting. Like, yep, that one has to stay on. Mm-hmm. And it was about the bankruptcy of Detroit. But I think overall it's amicable. There are emotions do run high for certain books, certainly.
Mm-hmm. Yep. Right. We tend to think of the literary centers of the United States as the cities where big publishing and big entertainment writing is centered. And obviously, there's a million great books coming out of New York and LA, the places where a lot of writers go to pursue their careers. But what do you feel like readers get out of reading local?
Part of it's just a better understanding of what's going on around you, or what's happened. One of the examples would be The World According to Fannie Davis. That book was really interesting to me. My father grew up in Detroit. I've lived most of my life actually in Lansing. But I'm reading this book about a woman whose mother ran numbers in Detroit in the African-American community. And I finished it and I turned to my father and said, the next time I saw him, and said, so did you guys, I mean, I've been told everybody did, but did you guys play numbers? And he's like, before I'd even finished the question, he's trying to come up with the name of the lady who would come and take their bets every day. She's sort of like stop in for tea type thing. And it was just neat.
That's fantastic.
It just, and it just led to a really interesting conversation. But it was just a part that it was very intrinsic to him growing up, but I knew nothing about it.
Yeah.
Jessica Trotter is a librarian with the Capital Area District Library. We've also been talking with Tim Gleisner, manager of special collections at the Library of Michigan. They are part of the shadowy cabal of readers and curators who bring us the list of Michigan notable books every year. You two, thank you so much. I know I'm going to be busy for the next couple of months.
Thank you.
Thanks for talking to us.
Thank you.
We have some interviews for you to listen to with some of the authors whose books are on this year's Michigan Notable Books list. Head over to the Michigan Radio website to find them. Coming up after the break, Martin Luther King Jr.'s address to a huge Detroit crowd in June 1963.
The march attracted 125,000 people, but they weren't probably all people that agreed on every aspect of the civil rights fight.
Stay with us. You're listening to Stateside from Michigan Radio. I'm April Baer. When Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. visited places around the United States in 1963, it was always an event. But Dr. King's arrival in Detroit in June of that year, with the speech he delivered to more than 100,000 people, was an important foretelling of things to come.
You develop the inner conviction that there are some things so dear, some things so precious, some things so eternally true that they are worth dying for.
Dr. King's time at the Detroit Walk to Freedom came several months before the famous March on Washington. And yet, this was the place where people would first hear some of the language and themes powering the iconic I Have a Dream speech, a speech that would galvanize the nation for change. We spoke with Detroit writer Ken Coleman, author of On This Day, African-American Life in Detroit. He also writes regularly for Michigan Advance. Ken, tell us, what was Dr. King doing in Detroit in 1963?
Dr. King frequently visited Detroit throughout the late 1950s and, of course, the 1960s. But 1963 was a very interesting year, both nationally and the civil rights fight, but also locally. There was an organization in Detroit formed only months before the June 1963 march called the Detroit Council for Human Rights. It was founded primarily by three African-American men in Detroit, Benjamin McFall, who is a prominent mortician. His family owned a funeral home. Second gentleman was the Reverend Albert Clegg, who later founded the Shrine of the Black Madonna Church. But the third founder of the Detroit Council for Human Rights was the Reverend C.L. Franklin. Mm. And of course, we know Reverend C.L. Franklin as being the dad of Aretha Franklin, the great soul singer.
Ever since I found the Christ, there's been something in my life.
But certainly in 1963, Reverend Franklin was a prominent figure in civil rights and really sort of a national figure in the civil rights movement and a very good friend of Dr. King's, Dr. Martin Luther King Jr.
The crowd roared, Black Power. Dr. King goes on to say, Black Power is now a part of the nomenclature of the national community. To some, it is downright frightening. To others, it heralds a new day of unity for Black people.
In fact, when Dr. King would visit Detroit throughout the mid to late 50s and up until 1963 and after, whenever he would visit Detroit, he'd often have dinner at the Franklin home. And so the two gentlemen, C.L. Franklin and Martin Luther King Jr., were great friends. And as this Detroit Council of Human Rights sets out to have this major march and rally on June 23rd, 1963, as the council seeks to do that, the Reverend C.L. Franklin, reaches out to his good friend, the Reverend Martin Luther King, to be a participant and the keynote speaker. And that's how that happened.
How would you describe what happenings in Detroit represented with respect to the movement in the rest of the country at that time?
Sure. It's a great question. 1963 was a pivotal year. If you look at the landscape of the city of Detroit in that year, African Americans made up about 35% to 40% of the city's population, of Detroit's population. But they weren't reflected in a lot of organizations and institutions, both in the public and private sector. For example, African Americans made up less than 5% of the sworn police officers in Detroit. And that was a real issue, particularly when it came down to police community relations, feeling in the black community that far too many times African Americans were harassed by white police officers. And so that was sort of the setting in terms of police community relations. But the local branch NAACP for several years had been picketing, targeting businesses, banks, grocery stores in the city for their dreadful hiring practices in terms of not hiring African Americans for any jobs, let alone key positions. And so it was a real pivotal time. And on June 12th, 1963, several days before the Walk for Freedom March, Medgar Evers, a major NAACP leader in Mississippi, was murdered.
In a vacant lot about 40 yards away, a sniper fired a single shot from a high-powered rifle at Evers' silhouette.
All we want you to do is keep going with this fight for freedom.
The bullet hit him in the back, crashed through his body, through a window into the house.
As you feel the pains of dogs here in Greenwood, we'll feel them in Jackson. We're going to win this fight for freedom. Thank you very much.
He died within an hour at a Jackson hospital.
The city of Jackson offers $5,000 reward to anyone who gives evidence leading to the arrest and the conviction of the guilty.
That was some of the backdrop going into the June 23rd Walk for Freedom march in Detroit.
This sounds like an incredibly dramatic moment.
No question about it.
So who was with Dr. King and Reverend Franklin on that day on the walk?
It was a who's who of leaders throughout Detroit proper and the state. And they included UAW President Walter Reuther.
And that we're going to build that solidarity to encompass every American, regardless of race or creed or color.
Former Governor John Swainson, Mayor Jerome Kavanaugh.
We had made really no national commitment on the part of the public or the Congress to really start to rebuild our cities, not just physically, but socially as well.
To be sure, in fact, Mayor Kavanaugh was instrumental in making sure that the permit process for the rally and the march and rally were able to be carried out. So the city government played a role with the Detroit Council for Human Rights and getting the Walk for Freedom going. Two sort of interesting individuals, or at least organizations that weren't represented at the 63 march in Detroit, were Governor George Romney. Governor Romney was a devout Mormon and almost never participated in activities on the Sabbath, on Sunday, that the march was carried out on. So the governor of the state, George Romney, was not there. Missing in action was the Detroit branch NAACP. The NAACP at that time was a little bit more of a conservative organization, certainly more conservative than the Detroit Council for Human Rights, and did not participate. In fact, Arthur Johnson, who is the secretary director at the time, wrote many years later in his memoir, he watched the marchers go into downtown Detroit, into Cobo Hall. He watched it from the rooftop of Cobo and did not participate in the march and then the culmination, the rally in Cobo Arena.
Do you know if he regretted that?
I think there was a degree of regret, to be sure. He went on to continue to have a strong, Arthur Johnson, a strong presence in Detroit civil rights and civil rights across the nation. And I think he would call that a missed opportunity.
It's very interesting that there was representation among Michigan's mainstream politicians, in addition to the A-listers of the civil rights movement at that time. Do you think that represents the temperature of Detroit at that moment, or more the context of everything else that was happening in the country?
Certainly, Detroit has been a leader in the area of civil and human rights, to be sure. I mean, we certainly look at the civil rights movement as having its, headquarters, if you will, in the South. But here in Detroit, activists in Detroit participated in many movements, some more conservative than others, some more radical than others. It would not be a surprise to observers at the time that Detroit would host a rally and march that attracted 125,000 people.
The Walk to Freedom was designed in part to recognize the inequalities in labor and society that existed in the North rather than just the blatant racism within a segregationist South. How was that message received in Detroit and in the metro region?
It was received well. It covered locally and nationally. What's interesting about the Walk for Freedom is that, particularly, and you only have to look to the founders of the Detroit Council for Human Rights to sort of have this illustrated and crystallized. Each of them had really their own agenda. They were all African-American men, McFaul, Clegg, and Franklin, but they were on different sort of spectrums of, you know, the ideological landscape when it comes to civil rights. Mm-hmm. Clegg eventually would found a nationalist, a black nationalist religious sect in the Shrine of the Black Madonna within several years after the march. Franklin was more mainstream, but certainly was to the left of national organizations like the NAACP. McFaul was a business leader, certainly interested in civil rights, but certainly had sort of an economic, was interested in economic independence for African Americans, or at least economic advancement. And so they represented different ideological positions, which I think caused a lot of people to kind of get in where they could fit in. The march attracted 125,000 people, but they weren't probably all people that agreed on every aspect of the civil rights fight. And I think that's what made the march, very interesting. And certainly one of the larger marches in Detroit history. A couple months later, the nation watches at the March on Washington. But really, Detroit was the real forerunner for that March on Washington in August of 1963.
The words may be very similar, but it feels like there might have been different contexts for hearing that speech with 125,000 people in Detroit in May of that year and hearing it with the massive crowd in Washington, D.C. in August. What message was Dr. King trying to convey that day in Detroit?
A couple of things. One, certainly, demanding really at that point that the American government respect African Americans and advance civil rights legislation. But the other really kind of dealt with the sort of societal inequities that really carried themselves out in terms of employment opportunities for African Americans. Really sort of that economic advancement and that, you know, that piece of the pie. So really sort of a two-pronged demand, if you will.
We'll be done. Trouble of the world.
The story goes that Mahalia Jackson was the one who encouraged Dr. King to give the dream speech in Washington, D.C. Do you know if he had intended to use what he'd said in Detroit at the March on Washington before that point?
It's a great question, and as it's been asked before, I haven't found research that would make the point that King consciously sort of used Detroit as a sort of training ground, if you will, for the I Have a Dream speech. There were elements of King's speeches that over time we've seen that were used in several opportunities. That nothing that I've been able to research suggests that it was a conscious decision to do I Have a Dream in Detroit, or whether or not there was an individual or individuals that encouraged him to offer the oratory that he did.
And such things are possible in a pre-internet world, where you can work on a speech over time in that way.
Absolutely. And if you can imagine, Martin Luther King by 1963 was in high demand, and you know, probably 250 days out of a 365-day year, he was on the road, if you will, offering his support in civil rights endeavors and probably working on speeches and oratory piece by piece and putting things together depending on where he was in the nation and what the issue was that day.
Ken, thank you for taking some time on this with us.
I appreciate it. Thank you.
Who can say it better than Dr. King himself? Let's listen to a bit of that historic speech from Detroit in June of 1963.
Now, I do not want to give you the impression that it's going to be easy. There can be no great social gain without individual pain. Before the victory for brotherhood is won, some will have to get scarred up a bit. Before the victory is won, some more will be thrown into jail. Before the victory is won, some, like Medgar Evers, may have to face physical death. But if physical death is the price that some must pay to free their children and their white brothers from an eternal psychological death, then nothing can be more redemptive. Before the victory is won, some will be misunderstood and called bad names. But we must go on with the determination and with the faith that this problem can be solved. And so I go back to the South not in despair. I go back to the South not with a feeling that we are caught in a dark dungeon that will never lead to a way out. I go back believing that the new day is coming. And so this afternoon I have a dream. It is a dream deeply rooted in the American dream. I have a dream that one day, right down in Georgia and Mississippi and Alabama, the sons of former slaves and the sons of former slave owners will be able to live together as brothers. I have a dream this afternoon that one day, one day little white children and little Negro children will be able to join hands as brothers and sisters. I have a dream this afternoon that one day, men will no longer burn down houses in the Church of God simply because people want to be free. I have a dream this afternoon that there will be a day that we will no longer face the atrocities that Emmett Till had to face or Medgar Evers had to face, but that all men can live with dignity. I have a dream this afternoon that my four little children will not come up in the same young days that I came up within, but they will be judged on the basis of the content of their character, not the color of their skin. I have a dream this afternoon that one day right here in Detroit, Negroes will be able to buy a house or rent a house anywhere that their money will carry them, and they will be able to get a job. Yes, I have a dream this afternoon. One day in this land, the words of Amos will become real. And justice will roll down like waters and righteousness like a mighty stream. I have a dream this evening that one day we will recognize the words of Jefferson that all men are created equal, that they are endowed by their Creator with certain unalienable rights, that among these are life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. I have a dream this afternoon. I have a dream this afternoon that the brotherhood of man will become a reality in this day. With this faith, I will go out and carve a tunnel of hope through the mountain of despair. With this faith, I will go out with you and transform dark yesterdays into bright tomorrows. With this faith, we will be able to achieve this new day when all of God's children, black men and white men, Jews and Gentiles, Protestants and Catholics, will be able to join hands and sing with the Negroes in the spiritual of all, free at last, free at last. Thank God Almighty.
I'm April Bear. Thanks for listening. Let's make it a day on, not a day off. We'll see you tomorrow.